Hi there! Welcome to The Manuscript. I'm Juliana Meyer, and in this podcast, we delve into the intersection of writing and the development of technology products. Every couple of weeks, we talk to people making a difference in technical writing, instructional design, UX writing, content strategy, and anywhere else there's someone thinking about content in digital products and the tech industry. If you want to keep up with our latest news and insights, pitch in on themes for us to talk about, and also get some behind the scenes, follow us on Twitter. The link is in our show notes. And don't forget to subscribe to The Manuscript wherever you get your podcasts, so you'll know whenever we publish a fresh new episode. And today we're really excited. We're going to cover journalism and activism and technology, interviewing Carlisa Johnson, who's a multimedia journalist based in Atlanta. So hello, Carlisa. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
On today's episode, we'll start by talking about Carlisa's career and her experience as a journalist. Then we'll dive deep into the connection between journalism and technology. And finally, talk about activism, Black Lives Matter movement, and tech. All right. So first of all, can you please introduce yourself and share with our listeners a little bit about your path?
Sure. So as Juliana said, I am Carlisa Johnson, and I am a multimedia digital journalist who's based in Atlanta. And a lot of my work has covered politics, it's covered education, and just a lot of different topics that really impact the people in America. And I initially went to school for opera, and I studied opera for many years. And I realized that I had a lot to say. And so I started off with a digital magazine, and then eventually I started freelancing. And now I am getting my master's in digital communication strategies. And so really kind of looking for ways to take journalism into the 21st century and exploring all that digital journalism has to offer.
Wow, that's quite a plot twist. I wasn't aware. So how did it feel to change careers from such different fields?
It was very, I don't want to say scary, but it was such a stark contrast because since I was, I don't know, as soon as I could speak, I knew I wanted to be a singer. And then I went to a performing arts high school. And then when I went to college, I was studying opera and I sang for so long. And I, you know, sang with a company in Italy and I did all of this stuff. But I still sing and I still do those sorts of things in my free time. But it was a matter of I wasn't passionate about it anymore. And so I had to find something that I wanted to do as a career that I felt passionate about and that I knew I was passionate about, which is journalism, because I have a lot to say. And I'm always trying to kind of get to the bottom of situations that impact people.
It's the first singer that we interview here at The Manuscript, and I'm so glad. If people want to listen to something that you have published, can they?
Sure. So I don't know if there's any recordings of opera, but singing in general, I am the director of Atlanta Resistance Revival Chorus, and we are a chorus that sings a lot of the civil rights movement's music from the 60s around the nation. Actually, there's a bunch of different choirs that sing. And so if you ever just search Atlanta Resistance Revival Chorus, you'll find us. And I'm usually singing the solo or directing the choir.
This is amazing. This story just keeps getting better. Oh my God, I'm so emotional. We'll add the link to our show notes for sure. And I really appreciate how you understood from an early start that you wanted to have your voice heard, whether it was through singing or through journalism. That's like a really brave move to have. So I congratulate you for having that self-awareness.
Thank you. I appreciate you actually making connection between the two, because in my mind, I'm just like, yeah, I didn't like it anymore, so I tried something new. But I guess it's again, I just have so much to say and I want to be heard.
All right. So you're involved in podcasting as well, right? Being the former editor of the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies podcast, also the Weekly Rundown and My Mama and Me. So can you share with us what they're about and the different things that you learn from each one?
Sure. So I really enjoy podcasting and I like interviewing people as well as being on the back end of things and listening to the interviews taking place. And so for the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies, it is a more academic based podcast that I used to work with at my school, Georgia State University. And it really took a look at graduates of the Andrew Young School of Policy Studies, which they ran a bunch of different topics from health sciences to looking at policy surrounding criminal justice in America and things like that. So when that was kind of one of the most educational podcasts I've ever worked with, in that each person had such intense knowledge about policy in America and things that really impacted everyone. And it seemed like it was a very specific topic, but when you step back, you realize that every person in America has interactions with criminal justice. Every person in America has interaction with things like highway building and healthcare and things like that. So it's really informative and a really great podcast to work with. Then we have two personal podcasts of mine. The Weekly Rundown is actually hosted by my mom, who's also a journalist. And My Mom and Me is a podcast I host with my mom. And both of those, for the Weekly Rundown, it's more, weekly news here in America. And it's really trying to figure out a way to make the news digestible, because in 2020 we've had so much happen and it's really hard to kind of weed through the news. And so that's what that one's for. And then My Mom and Me is just my mom and I having conversations about everything from our relationship to mental health and things like that, and things that specifically impact Black American women.
And also on your website, you mentioned that your work focuses on race and gender politics, specifically highlighting experiences within the African diaspora. This really caught our attention, considering Breno and I are both from Brazil and discussions about the African diaspora are also being held here, considering that 56% of Brazilians recognize themselves as Black or Brown. And we also host the largest African population outside of Africa in our country. So this is like some hot topics that are also being discussed here. We'd love to hear your perspective as a journalist writing those stories. What's the role of storytelling in raising awareness about those issues?
Sure. So I really focus in on those issues, and especially being a Afro-Latina and having that specific experience being a Black Latinx person. But I know that quite often in these discussions of groups that are, in America at least, minority groups and who have like long been disenfranchised, there is often a bad habit of journalists to consider these people as voiceless, when in actuality, these people are never voiceless. And these groups of individuals are actually, they just need their voices to be amplified. So in the storytelling, I'm seeking ways to amplify their voices and to allow their stories to be heard on larger platforms. And in doing this, I really work to highlight the solutions that they're finding in challenges they're facing, or looking at the positive things that they are experiencing and the positive things that they are doing, as well as highlighting those moments for growth and the disenfranchisement that they're experiencing, really highlighting their experiences, but doing so in such a way that allows them to create the narrative of their own personal story.
That's why I'm so excited to be having this episode and to be talking about those themes and how we can use stories and writing and also technology to make those stories be heard and to make them reach places that they didn't before. I think it was Chimamanda Adichie who did a TED Talk about the danger of a single story. And it's something that always comes to my mind. And I'm really glad to be talking to you about this, because not only you're really passionate about those subjects, but you're also impacting different people in lots of ways to make those stories feel heard. So yeah, really excited here.
Thank you.
We're gonna talk about journalism and tech for this next block, considering our show is about writing and technology. So we're really glad to be talking about journalism and tech today. That's such a vital aspect in today's world of misinformation. And so we established some baselines here for all of our listeners who aren't journalists or who would like to know a bit more about how the day-to-day of a journalist is, how do you think those universes interact today, journalism and tech? How can journalism benefit from being in touch with tech, and how can it be negatively affected, in your opinion?
Sure. So journalism is going digital. That's the first thing, is that a lot of times, unfortunately, like physical journalism that's in newspapers, magazines, it's kind of a dying breed. And so a lot of things are going online, and it's forcing journalists to take stock of, well, what will look best on the screen for readers? How long is an audience staying on a page? Where do I need to put the most information? How do I need to, you know, utilize this? But then we also see things like social media and journalists having to address SEO and algorithms and things like that. And it's beneficial in many ways in that now we're getting more eyes on our work, and it's going international, and it's a much more worldly sense of journalism, especially here in America, where we're so focused on ourselves often. But negatively, it's also forcing journalists to have immediate reactions, or they're having to come to terms with audiences' immediate reactions, in that now we immediately know if people don't like our work because they can just simply click no, share it with a bad review and things like that. But we also have things like digital journalism now, where we also are using our cell phones for mobile journalism. We're able to do tons of different recordings, video recordings, audio recordings, in ways that it was inaccessible before, unless you had a full crew, unless you worked for a major corporation that gave you the equipment that was expensive. Now, the definition of a journalist is really anyone with a armed with a phone who's willing to expose the truth. And so it's making journalism more accessible, which is a good thing, but it's making journalism more accessible. And at the same time, it can be a bad thing, because some of those don't necessarily have good intentions.
There's like a dichotomy about giving voice to people, regardless of what they're saying, which might be not so beneficial for democracy in the end of the day. So I guess that the role of journalists has definitely been highlighted in this shift, not just diminished. So yes, lots of responsibilities for you guys to make some really professional journalism and to guard what the truth really means, right?
Yeah, and I mean, you've touched on something that's really important, which is that democracy quite often hinges on a free press and our ability to deliver the information in an unbiased way, without the influence of politics and without the influence of propaganda. And for Americans especially, we were very close to having that free press go away. And so luckily we're hanging on strong for journalists, but we're in a very precarious situation as journalists in America.
In Brazil, I'm not sure what's the exact position, but there was a global survey about what were the most dangerous countries for journalists to work on, and Brazil was like right at the top. And this makes me really sad, considering my brother and sister are journalists. And it's definitely a much needed profession, which is in danger. And us as a society need to cherish those professionals who are really giving all that they have to deliver the truth to us. So we should be grateful and supportive.
Exactly.
And a quick digression just before we get into the next question, because this is like some big news that's happening here in Brazil this week. So have you heard of the Sleeping Giants initiative?
No, I don't think I have.
I'm pretty sure it started in the US, but it's just like this platform led by regular people where they survey websites that display fake news or misinformation of any kind. And then they see what companies are advertising in those websites. And then they tweet pressuring those companies to remove the ads from those websites, so their brand is not connected to that sort of message. And this way they can defund those really negative websites and take them off air, because their source of income is taken away from them. This is like a business model that is really working. And it started here in Brazil, like in May of this year. And it was just like anonymous Twitter accounts that was pressuring all these giant companies to take their ads away from sites that were spreading misinformation. And they actually managed to take away 1.5 million reais out of circulation from those websites, which is great for our democracy and preservation of the truth and actual journalism. And they came out of their anonymous status because there were all of these conspiracy theories about who they were. And turns out it's just a couple of 22-year-olds from the interior of Brazil who just started this out of their hearts and voluntarily. And I think it's a great way to illustrate like the power that technology has brought to democratizing the internet and how we make news happen. But they're suffering all sorts of attacks and threats, which is terrible.
Yeah, and that's an amazing story. And it really demonstrates the dichotomy that we're all forced to reconcile with, in that, like you said, it really does, the internet and technology really does democratize the news and what we receive. And it really, I just wrote a paper about this for school, but one of the things that we see with this rise of social media and the way that people use it and perform activism on it, just like the two 22-year-olds are doing with Sleeping Giants, is that it's there because it creates a counter narrative to mainstream news and mainstream media, mm-hmm. because sometimes that's necessary, because typically the people who are performing activism in this way, they are people who don't necessarily have power. Instead, they have to gain power through combination with other people and things like that. And so they don't typically have access to the media in the same way as other people. And so it really demonstrates this counter narrative and the way that people are utilizing that for good. So it's a wonderful story to hear.
Cool. And you're also involved in the Ground Truth Project, whose mission is to restore journalism from the ground up by supporting the next generation of journalists through field reporting that serves undercover corners of the United States and the world. You're a voting rights fellow at the project, right? Can you tell us a bit about their work and what you do in your day to day?
Sure. So, the Ground Truth Project is a really great platform, and it's something that we see a lot here in the United States, is that we have, instead of just the major corporations that exist that people usually think of with news, like CNN or Fox News or the BBC, we have nonprofit news organizations that are, I don't want to say less biased, but they're kind of less biased. And so a lot of my reporting is really trying to get at on the ground reporting and what's happening locally. And again, trying to amplify the voices of these people who usually are seen as voiceless, when in actuality, they're screaming at the top of their lungs, trying to get attention, and people are just ignoring them. So I've covered the 2020 presidential election here in Georgia, which in terms of American politics, it really came down to where I live, which is Georgia, in the southern part of America, which is home to civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King and people like that. And so it really was a matter of highlighting this legacy that has continued on until 2020 and further, and show the importance of Georgia, which is just a small part of America, but how we really defined this election cycle, and how we're really in Georgia, how Georgia's really kind of become this proponent for elections that's just, you can't ignore it anymore.
That's amazing. It must feel really good to be on the front lines and talking to people locally, but also spreading that type of narrative to the whole world.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful to work with the Ground Truth Project specifically, because they do have this, even though I'm a voting rights fellow, and it's very focused on America, as a organization, they're very worldly, and they have young journalists and some established, some new journalists kind of planted all around the world. And so they really, like when they say on the ground journalism, they mean people who are from this location, know it in and out, and are really able to share these stories.
We're now entering our next block, where we'll talk about activism and tech. So, Carlisa, we came across your story by reading an MIT Technology Review article by Tanya Basu called, quote, "How Google Docs Became the Social Media of the Resistance," end quote. We have lots of questions about this, but let's start from the beginning. So can you share with us the story from your perspective? What were the events that led to you being featured in this article? So basically, what happened?
Sure. So as many of you know, this summer, we had the murder of Breonna Taylor and the murder of George Floyd at the hands of American police officers. And when this happened, there was a large outpouring of people seeking ways to demand accountability. And as a journalist, I know that a lot of times you have to weed through a lot of information that may not be accessible or may not be easily understood. Because as a journalist, I'm always thinking, okay, how do I communicate this in the simplest way possible and in the most accessible way for people to understand it? And so I also consider myself an activist and organizer. And so I also know what it takes to demand accountability, and I know who I can turn to, what organizations to turn to look at what their demands are and then be able to kind of share this. And so I kind of saw myself as a middleman during this and created this document that ended up, it started off as like 2 pages. And by the end of the summer, it was like almost, it was like 15 pages, 20 pages, something like that, because there was so much that people were, they wanted to help, ways to donate, how to get involved. If you are going to protest, because in America, a lot of people attended their first protest this year, what safety precautions do you need to take when you are attending protests? Kind of what organizations you can trust to actually donate money and expect that if you get in trouble at a protest, what do you need to do and things like that. So I created this document, and initially, because I am a master's student and a lot of my friends are academics, I shared it on Facebook and then they shared it with their friends. And so it really traveled through a lot of different college campuses across America, both like undergraduate and graduate and postdoctoral students, and really traveled through there. And then one day, I started receiving like an influx of followers a little bit and an influx of emails from younger people. And I was like, I'm almost 30. I don't know why these teenagers are following me. And I realized that Cole Sprouse, who is an American actor of note, he's on the show Riverdale, which is a really popular like teen drama.
Basically, he's my lifelong crush. But carry on.
Well, he had shared my document, and he had been sharing it like for several days, and suddenly there were like, it had like 100,000 views like in one day, and it was just like really not spiraling, but a lot of people were accessing it to gain this information. And so from there, a lot of people, it became one of the documents of note during this, when a lot of people were seeking ways to get involved with the Black Lives Matter movement.
Oh my God. Okay, so I have many questions. First of all, let me just establish that this makes me 1 degree away from Cole Sprouse. So I'm actually really glad to hear that. But carrying on about the more serious questions, do you remember what you felt like when you first opened the Google Docs and started writing? What did it feel like? What did you think was going to happen then?
Sure. So on like a personal level, I had been sitting, I was so frustrated for several days, and I had sat and I cried. And I was like, because of the coronavirus, I couldn't leave my house. I couldn't go to protests because I live with someone who has a compromised immune system, and they're more susceptible to disease. So I was sitting there and I was like, the things that I usually do when something bad happens, I couldn't do. I couldn't go to the Capitol and demand or whatever. I couldn't do anything. So I was sitting there frustrated, and I said, okay, Carly, so you're a journalist, figure this out. So I sat down and I started organizing my thoughts in some sort of way for people to figure out, okay, this is what you need to do. You call this person, then you do this. So I it literally, I went on autopilot after a while because it was the only way I could feel like I was taking action in any way. And I was taking action that actually mattered. So that was my thinking. And it kind of, I spiraled a little bit where I wasn't sleeping and I would be getting up like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, checking to see if anybody, if there were any new calls to action or if someone, if people had been arrested and they were like a big batch of people were arrested and they needed donations for, to get them out of jail, or if anyone had gone missing, unfortunately. So these, like, a lot was going on. And so I was really tuned into that, like a journalist would be, and really, you know, using my resources and looking for sources, to really, to expand upon this and to make it as useful as possible.
It must have felt great, at least, to channel that energy into something concrete.
Thank you. Yeah, it was. It's, that's really what it was, is that I was like, what tools do I know how to use in such a way that it's, like you said, concretely a tool, like something that I can do that was concrete, but also something that really cuts down the barrier that people feel a lot of times when it comes to activism. People don't know how to get involved. So I was looking for ways to really make it more accessible. That was at the end of the day.
For the next few questions, I would like to read a few excerpts from the MIT Technology Review article from Tania Basu. So, quote, Facebook and Twitter might have the bells and whistles, but the word processing software's simplicity and accessibility have made it a winning tool. End quote. So do you agree with this opinion? What made Google Docs your chosen medium?
Sure, I completely agree with this statement in that, like, Google has its own hangups, you know, in terms of like security and surveillance and things like that. But at the end of the day, Google Docs offers a way for you to have everything in one spot. You can have multiple links. You can have these pages and pages in one singular location that makes it really accessible. And at the end of the day, like I mentioned, accessibility was my goal. So I knew that Google Docs was the way to go about doing that.
It's so easy to get a Google Docs up and running. Like, if you have chosen to create a whole website for this, it would take much more effort and time and resources, and it wouldn't be so easily updated, right? And not even going into the whole collaborative aspect of the Google Docs. So yeah, it was a great choice of medium. Another excerpt from the article reads, quote, what's special about a Google Doc versus a newsfeed is its persistence and editability, says Clay Shirky, the vice provost for educational technology at the New York University. In 2008, Shirky wrote, Here Comes Everybody, the Power of Organizing Without Organizations, detailing how the internet and social media helped shape modern protest movements, end quote. So diving a bit about what this excerpt brings, the collaborative aspect of Google Docs that since 2012 enabled users to edit simultaneously the same document is definitely very much in tune with today's global networks. How do you feel this medium has raised the voices of the people collectively? And can you comment about the themes that came up from this excerpt?
Yeah, again, it goes back to democratizing the internet and technology. And so one thing is that Google Docs is free. You're not having to pay for a website or for a server that's going to hold all the information that you're having. That accessibility also goes to the interface in that it's really simple. You're not having to do anything on the back end to update a document. It's just right there. You type it in and it's there and it saves automatically. And it's a lot of, it takes out the guesswork of technology for a lot of people. And so, I mean, it has allowed people to utilize it in such a way that it breaks down a lot of barriers. And it's because it's shareable in speed of light, it's also able to amplify the work that people are doing too in terms of organizing.
Yeah, and it makes me really glad to be involved in tech and also in writing, because I feel that they're both powerful in their own ways, but when combined, we can really change things. And yeah, makes my heart warm.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
So if people want to be more active towards a certain cause and maybe engage a community about it, where should they begin? What should they have in mind?
Sure. So to start off, they need to have a method of organizing their thoughts, because I'm a really scatterbrained person. So really creating a clear way to organize their thoughts to make sure that it is accessible for everyone. And then the brilliant thing is that you can always go back and edit, change whatever you need to do. So it's a matter of just getting started and making sure that you know that you can come back to it, add what you need to, and then really utilizing social media to share it across platforms and to share it across communities and things like that. And another one of the key things to sharing my document was, is that the unfortunate thing about Google Docs is that you can't edit the URL. But I created, I shortened the link so that it was just bit.ly/Black Lives Action. And so making it, that's kind of my social media savvy, because I've worked as a social media manager, is that knowing that I have this shortened link that I can just, if people are like, well, where do we go? Bit.ly dot, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so making that shortened link is really imperative to spreading it, because if people have to type in docs.google.com/document, blah, 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 you know, you can't really share that. So that's one of the key things to the success of the document as well.
To make it really rememberable.
Yes.
That's so interesting. And how did it gain traction after you launched it? So you mentioned that students from different universities were sharing it amongst their networks. But how do you go from that to making it be featured by Cole Sprouse and the MIT Technology Review? How to make that leap?
Sure. Well, the first thing is content, in that there were many Google Docs that popped up in this 2020 iteration of Black Lives Matter, and each one had its own benefits. But one of the things that I did was I made it so that someone who has never, you know, contacted an elected official, never attended a protest, can really see step by step what it is that you have to do. How do you contact someone? How do you send a letter to, you know, a congressperson in our United States Senate or something like that? So it's really comes down to what your content is and how you've tailored it for your audience, just like regular journalism and tech writing.
Perfect. And so you made the document editable for anyone who had access to the link right from the beginning, or was it something that was incorporated later on?
Oh, no, no, no. So I actually, here in America, I mean, all over the world, Black Lives Matter is a very contentious subject. And there's a lot of people who do not agree with the statement, and they make this known that they do not agree with the statement. And sometimes it's just a verbally saying that, but sometimes it's acts of violence, sabotage, and things like that. So the document was, when I initially posted it, it was anonymous because I was a little scared that this could be used against me in some way, or that if people knew too much about me, that they would seek to cause harm in some way, because it is a very contentious thing. But I eventually added my name as well as email if you would like to submit anything to be added or edited. So it was a process of adding an email address where you could submit any changes that you wanted to add.
Yeah, I was reluctant about asking this question before, because part of me didn't want to believe that people would actually compromise such a beautiful initiative like the one that you started. But of course, it's a really polarizing subject here in Brazil as well. So I understand that these measures had to be taken to make sure that you were safe, and also the project itself was durable, right?
Yes. And the reason, I mean, at the end of the day, I also had to kind of come out of the shadows, if you will, was because it was like the 22-year-olds that you mentioned from the Sleeping Giants initiative. People need to be able to verify the information you're giving them. And so if you have a name behind it, you can see that this is a real person, what they stand for. Our Black Lives Matter movement is really decentralized, but I've been a part of it, or I've been a part of movement work and organizing work here in America for, you know, 5-6 years. So people can see this and understand that it's something that's not malicious. It doesn't have a malicious intent, and that it's truly verifiable information.
All right. So any final words for anyone interested in joining anything of the projects that you work on, or anyone who's feeling inspired to work on projects for themselves?
Yeah, the information is always there. The way to start is always there, because now with technology, you don't really have to wait for anyone to give you permission to be a journalist or to give you permission to be an activist. You have your own platform, you have social media, you have websites like medium.com where you can post whatever within reason, but what you, your work and what you'd like to post. So you have, like, the world is your oyster at this point. The internet is your oyster. So, you know, go after it, do what you need to do, and get it.
Okay, that was a great way to finish this episode. And we're now gonna close things off like we generally do. So this is the moment in the manuscript where we ask our guests their thoughts on the future of their respective areas. So what trends do you see in journalism, and especially in activism?
Sure. I think that the trend that we're seeing a lot is the decentralizing of major journalist corporations or major news corporations. They're still around, but we see a lot of smaller news organizations popping up that really have a deeper understanding of the communities they're reporting on. And so independent news is becoming more popular, and it's all thanks to technology, the internet, and social media.
Amazing. So we have a final question where we ask our guests, what are their book recommendations? So, Carlisa, what book is currently on your nightstand? What are you reading right now?
Sure. So I actually got it as an early Christmas present, and it's a book called Hood Feminism, which, like I said, I'm really interested in race and gender politics. And so it's really reconciling the ideals of modern feminists as a Black woman. And so it's a really great book that explores, for anyone interested in feminism, it explores topics of disenfranchisement, empowerment, and, you know, it really just shares experiences of one woman, one Black woman's perspective.
Amazing, really inspiring. And also, what book or article would you recommend to our listeners so they can learn more about what journalism and tech mean? Or do you have any professional books in your area that really inspired you along your path?
Yeah, I'm always like, what books as a journalist do I read? And half the time, the book that I pull the most, which this is so cheesy, but the AP style book, because it really offers such insight into making sure that your writing is accessible and that you're able to write to everyone's understandability, and that you're using good writing style. So the AP style book, I think that's the one I would suggest.
Great tip. Great tip for our writers out there and whoever wants to be a better writer. All right. Thank you so much, Carlisa. This episode has definitely been a special one. I think everyone will learn a lot from our conversation, and I'm really honored that you accepted our invitation and that you've spoken so eloquently about topics that aren't easy to talk about for most people. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure to speak with you and also reflect on the work that is, it's kind of hard to think about 2020, but to really take a step back and look at it.
Thanks for tuning in at The Manuscript. And by the way, we created a Goodreads bookshelf assembling all of our guests' book recommendations. So from Harry Potter to strategic writing for UX, our list will definitely inspire you. And the link for that and all links mentioned in today's episode are in our show notes. And we know we have a very specific scope on our show. It's not every day that you see independent Latin American podcasts about technology and writing that are written, produced, and edited by a team of only two people who happen to be Brazilian colleagues. So yeah, very specific. And your support is super important to fuel our project, and it's also completely free of charge. You can support us by subscribing to our show wherever you get your podcasts, by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, and most importantly, by sharing it with a friend. See you next time!